All right, welcome to session 324, Mormon Mental Health Association, a discussion of what's not up for discussion. Just a reminder before we get going to turn off your cell phones and also to please hold your questions till after the presentations are over. Our presenters today are Joshua Neal, who practices psychotherapy at Capitol Hill Therapy, which he owns in Seattle. He identifies as Mormonish. And Jonathan Adderhold, who practices psychotherapy at Silver Skies Counseling, which he also owns and which is also in Seattle. He is an active Mormon. All right, Joshua and Jonathan.
Thank you for coming. Just have to thank Natasha for putting together the Mormon Mental Health Association and Lindsay for Sunstone. It's really an honor to be here and really exciting to be able to talk with all of you today. So obviously, what we're discussing is a discussion of what's not up for discussion. Most of us have probably had conversations that maybe haven't gone as well as you would have liked, or you wanted to talk about something that wasn't available.
Or you started and then the discussion was shut down immediately.
which is what we're talking about today. So we have this fun little intro here. There's one of the goals that we're kind of setting out here today is to disabuse most of us of these ideas that we have around what is actually happening when we engage with each other in these conversations and with ourselves. So I thought this was kind of funny. Most folks kind of have this construct in their mind of a very rational, logical, thoughtful idea of approaching ideas that, oh, I bend with the facts, I'm not opinionated, whatever. When in reality, most of us are kind of cherry-picking what's valuable for us in our own lives. And so that's kind of what we're getting into today.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and so from the get-go, we have these underlying assumptions that we have when we enter into a conversation with someone else. Oftentimes these are subconscious. They're not something that we are actively thinking about in any given moment, but these assumptions determine a lot of what the approaches that we will take in a conversation and the things that we expect to happen, and we will see that oftentimes these assumptions can get us in trouble. A few of these things that we assume that are happening are that we're talking about the same thing, that might not be the case, even if you are using the same words. A true blue Mormon who has a different concept of what the Book of Mormon means to them versus someone who has left the church. And even if you enter the conversation with using the same phrase, the Book of Mormon, those things have very different connotations, very different meanings attached to them. You are talking about the Book of Mormon, but is that the same thing for each person? Secondly, what we personally value, we often associate with being true. We're going to be talking about what one of the terms we'll use is objective reality. We often think that these values that we have, these truths that we hold dear to ourselves, are objective when oftentimes they can be quite subjective, or somebody else's opinion or take on them is subjective in such a sense that we're not even talking about the same issue when we come into a conversation with them. We have an analogy for kind of helping us to illustrate this, which Josh will go into detail explaining.
Yeah, so essentially, I like to think about it this way. This morning I went to John Hamer's Many Mormonisms Maps. I don't know if any of you went to that. But one of the things that stuck out to me in that is there's all these different ways to organize information. And there's certain things that we all pay attention to. And that's mostly informed by our values. And so that's, again, what I'm saying is, like, we're trying to go really deep here and not into content, but looking at how we approach the world, how we map our world, and how that informs where we end up and how we end up coming together. One of the ways that I like to talk about that is thinking about different games that we all play. So, you know, looking at checkers versus chess as two different ways to engage a game. And both of these games have their own rules, and they have their own ways of interacting with each other. If you come to a person who is playing checkers and you start to play chess, you're going to start to have some problems. Because before you even get into the game, there's all these rules that each of you bring, all these assumptions, all these ways of engaging the world or mapping or making sense of it. And those, Jonathan and I are arguing, are more based on your values than they are on logical, objective truth, like most of us want to believe. Which brings us to kind of how do these rules develop? How do we get to these? Or rather, what are these rules? So we want to take a second to talk about what they are. We both went to school at Seattle University, and the way that we studied there was basically always going really deep into the philosophical underpinnings of some of these arguments. And one of the individuals that we read, his name's Stolaro, he talks about absolutisms. And so that's essentially, you can sub that in for the rules of the game you're playing, whether that's checkers, whether that's chess, whether it's Connect Four, whatever it is, however you're making sense of the world, it's based in these absolutisms, these unquestionable ways that you approach it. They can be often deeply held beliefs or values. And one of the key points here is that most of the time we're playing our game, we're not actually discussing the rules of our game. We're just playing it. And the rules are actually never up for discussion. It's like, no, that's how it works. That's how it operates. That's how you play checkers. That's how you play chess. And so that's one of the things that is a key feature of these absolutisms, is that they are not available to be discussed. And we'll go a lot more into that. But I don't know if you wanted to talk about.
Yeah, and so, I mean, we have some examples listed of what could be considered an absolutism. So a belief that the prophets are God's mouthpiece and they're infallible, and what they say is the word of God all the time. That's a deeply held belief that that some people have, and challenging that belief can get them on the defensive. Other things, you know, tradition is good and important. Science can explain everything. So, like, you know, Religion isn't the only area where this exists, and we will illustrate that further. And this is a great example. Is that idea that everything can be explained through science and through undertaking the scientific method and hypothesis and testing, that can explain everything. And of course, you know, current political debates we got here: guns. And so, like, you know, on either side of that debate, whether it's whether you're being patriotic with it or whether you consider it a great evil, both of those stances rely on these absolutisms, these values that people hold dear.
Yeah, and one of the reason we brought up some of these more hot button topics is we wanted to understand that these things happen within the Mormon world, but they also happen everywhere. So many times I've had conversations with folks around science. I value science. I love science. I think it's so important, and I love the method. But the method comes from a branch of knowledge, and there's other branches of knowledge and inquiry that have different domains. And science is no different than superstition when misapplied to domains of knowledge that it can't discuss. It's like saying, what's the value of a poem based on the qualities of the ink scientifically? You know, it's incongruent. They're different games that we're playing. And so a lot of times, like we said, when you enter these conversations, people just kind of stop. They shut down. So if you say, we need to take everyone's guns, people are like, nope, not up for discussion. If you say, we need to give everyone guns, nope, not up for discussion. They're completely evil. They're completely good. This happens across the spectrum of politics. But there's a reason for these. And so we don't want to make this sound like it's all bad. Absolutisms actually serve a really valuable purpose in our lives. And so part of the goals that we want to accomplish here is help us understand why these are so useful. What purpose do they serve so that we can start to maybe have a little more compassion in ourselves and hopefully a lot more compassion in others when we do bump up against those various absolutisms.
Yeah, and so like, you know, we don't want to give the impression that, okay, so absolutisms are the root cause of all these arguments and disagreements that we're having, so let's get rid of them. That would be quite bad, as we were about to illustrate here, because we would lose all the benefits that they do provide in our lives. And these benefits range from giving us a sense of stability and a sense of security to helping us out with efficiency. So, you know, just as an example, for efficiency's sake, if we have to like evaluate our stances and our views every time a hot button topic gets presented to us, you know, we'll use that guns example again. If every time someone makes an argument about guns, you have to ask yourself, well, where do I stand on that? Then, you know, that's not efficient. It helps you to get to a stance. It helps you to have that confidence when approaching that argument, and so you don't have to reevaluate your stance every time someone brings that up.
Well, there's also the continuity piece. Keeping a cohesive sense of the world is deeply important for us, and these are again some of my assumptions, is that our brain isn't functioning to have this quest to categorize and organize objective truth. What it's doing is it's trying to survive. It's trying to make things simple. It's trying to get you through the day so you can eat food and reproduce. And so when we're looking at it that way, these things are deeply important. You don't have time to sit there. You know, there could be a lion chasing you. You know, when we think about how our brain evolved, there could be a potential mate walking by. There could be a food opportunity. Those are the things your brain needs to worry about. And a lot of these other things need to get backburnered.
And you know, those are all opportunities or threats that if you take too long to evaluate, you could miss it, or you could be in trouble and die.
Yes, exactly. So so that's what we want to kind of put out here is these things don't enter the arena of dialogue. They're protected from that because they function really well in keeping us alive. And we experience a lot of distress when certain things that we have insulated from dialogue get forced into the arena, whether it's internal dialogue or whether it's interpersonal dialogue. It's usually a lot easier for us to function when those things are just kept maybe on the shelf, as we might say. So let's see. Kind of talked about most of this.
So I want to address this third point here. As we mentioned, they can provide this sense of stability and assurance, and we'll eventually be talking about the concept of the world view. We'll get into that later. But before we move on, I do want to go into kind of a closer analysis of something to help illustrate this concept on a more personal level for everyone. So, as Josh mentioned before, one of the influential people in our curriculum that we studied at our grad school, man named Stallaro, he wrote the article that we were drawing a lot of the ideas of absolutisms from, and he includes personal experience from it that is extremely powerful and very influential in his life, and hopefully I can do it some justice, but he was a married man, and he lived with his wife. They were married for many years, just like many of us who are married, you can say to your spouse, I'll see you later, and you expect that to be true. Well, one day Stallaro woke up, and his wife had passed away. And she was there in the bed, and she was gone. And you know, prior to that, he had always assumed that statement, "I'll see you later," "I'll see you in the morning," that was a true statement. And for him, that was an absolutism that was here because of trauma, changed forever for him. And whenever he hears that statement from now on, he is forced to question it because of his life experience, that that cannot always be true. And, you know, and he even points out, he goes so far to say that such a statement is a delusion, because there, we have no way of knowing that we'll see our loved ones again. There's an infinite number of possibilities that could occur that could shatter this fragile life as we know it. And as you think about it, you can conceptualize how unnerving that can be, how scary that can be, how anxiety-provoking that can be. I mean, if you ever want to think about what it's like to live with anxiety, that's kind of a window into that, is to imagine what it's like that all these givens in life that you feel so comfortable that are going to happen have no assurance, have no surety, and that's what it's like to live that way. And so because of these absolutisms, because we have these things in place, they can give us that sense of security, help us to not be so caught up in these things. And like they say here, they're requisite for daily functioning. And so, you know, as we're pushing forward, and we do want to be very careful that we don't yank these away from people before they're ready. But even though that they are very helpful and useful to us, we are going to now dive into all the things that can make it go wrong. Because these absolutisms, while very helpful and efficient and necessary for life, can get in the way of a lot of things. And nobody expects the Spanish Inquisition. And here we have an extreme example of this in history, in which one camp of ideology based on an absolutism was so heavily enforced and so insulated from dialogue that anyone who dared object against it did so risking their life. And many people died because of this. Many people were tortured. Many atrocities occurred because of this, because of the rigidity of their belief system, because of how deeply held, how deeply they clung to their absolutisms.
One way I like to think about this is like you show up there with your checkerboard and they're like, "We play chess here. Now you die." So I like to kind of hit on that analogy. But another analogy that I think is really useful for this to understand why these things can become so protected, like the story that Jonathan shared, is these things are structural. I like to think of them kind of like the frame of your house. You can rearrange the furniture. You can, you know, somebody can critique the carpet, whatever. It might be annoying, but you're going to live. You know, somebody comes in with a sledgehammer and starts taking away the support beams in your house, you might get a little upset, you know, because you're going to die, the roof's going to fall in, things are going to get bad. And so that understanding that those things are structural for people to hold together a cohesive sense of self and reality, and that they're very based in each individual person's values, can show us why it can get so out of hand, why it can get so ugly when people come in and start attacking those. And occasionally, you know, I wanted to add to the story of Stalrose, it's true that you might not ever see another person that you love, that you say goodbye to. My story is I've left Mormonism, whatever that means. I no longer practice the rituals or believe the truth claims. But one of the things that really bothered me a lot in doing that was I would hear these folks who were kind of transitioning with me make these claims about the way that they construct the world. And it often struck me as quite pompous and kind of annoying. They'd be like, "Oh, I only believe the truth. I only believe the facts. Why aren't these people listening to the facts, to the truth?" And nobody does that. And that's what I want to keep hitting on here, is I want to disabuse all of us of this idea that any of us are these pure, rational, logical things. What we're doing is we're surviving and we're holding together a cohesive sense of reality. And we are willing to literally attack and go at anyone that's going to challenge that, just like you would if somebody came into your house with a sledgehammer going after the support beams. Worst case scenario, we get to the Spanish Inquisition. looking at kind of some of the ways that people do defend these, I mean, maybe some of you all, I mean, we're also just to put out here, we welcome any feedback or questions that any of you have at any point during this. We'll also have a Q&A. So if any of you have any particular things you want to add, just raise your hand. But when folks, well, I think maybe that's on the next slide. I don't want to get too ahead of myself here. Have any of you ever had, like, put forth an idea that wasn't popular and seen what happened to you? You're just raising your hand, just agreeing, yeah, it's happened. Or if you want to share, stand up, but any of you, yeah? Did you? Facebook. Yes, yes. Yes. Anyone else, any other times? Yeah. Yeah, so I just want to repeat so this is getting recorded. So just the idea that that the church wasn't ready for the blacks, not the other way around, was introduced, and they've lost their minds, right? They just couldn't handle that. Okay, and then did we have...
No.
Oh, okay. So those are just a few of these, and we have multiple examples. But I really want to keep hammering home, and I'm going to keep repeating this, is we ideally we get the furthest when we let go of this idea that we are this logical, appropriate, rational, objective being. And we start to understand that we're surviving and so are other people. And we're engaging and we're always bumping up against each other, and we're all trying to preserve our structure of ourself, our structure of reality, or our house, and we want to keep it that way.
Mm-hmm. No, keep it on to... Because something we need to mention before moving to the next slide. One of the clearest and most obvious examples of how people will defend their absolutisms is to label and discredit the other, to demonize them, to make them out to be the bad guy. Do we have a comment there? Absolutely, yeah. And so the comment was,
yeah, no, that's right.
Yeah, yeah. You were bingo. You were correct. Ad hominem attacks. Ad hominem attack the character of the individual and not their argument. That's an easier approach. If that other person credibility is out the window, then it doesn't matter what they say. It doesn't matter what opinion they hold. We don't have to deal with it because they're trash. And so, like, some of the ways we do this, call people evil, call people stupid, call people backwards, hippie, commie, fundamentalist, socialist. These are labels that can be used by one side or the other of any argument to say, I don't have to listen to what that person says. Their opinion doesn't matter.
Their game is stupid. We play checkers in this house. So this is just getting into kind of looking a little deeper onto, and this is kind of informed by Nietzsche and this idea that God represents objective reality, not that God represents the Judeo-Christian tradition of an actual entity or being. So when I say challenging God here, I really am saying, like, fundamentally striking at somebody's core fundamentals of what they believe objective reality is, and pushing into this other project of, like, just being human and connecting and talking about our values and why we live the way we do. Let's see. Oh, and so what can happen is when you do kind of question somebody's objective reality, like we talked about, they often will brand you certain things. They'll try to disqualify you and get you out of the picture. But one thing that I want to add here is this doesn't mean that you can't play a really bad game of checkers. So if somebody's playing checkers and you're playing checkers and you're playing a bad game, they can point that out. So within the realm of science, for example, there's pseudoscience, which in my opinion is just really bad checkers. Now, there's some really other great games that people can play that I think are super important and matter and need to be explored and done. But there's also this thing that happens where even in the games we play, they can be there's really beautiful games and there's other ones that are not so good.
So we don't have to defend bad arguments. We don't have to defend bad games of checkers. Right. Those can be critiqued.
Right. So you can both say scientific reductionism and the misapplication of science to domains of inquiry where it doesn't extend is bad, and you can also say pseudoscience is not useful either. However, just be prepared. When you come up against someone's objective reality, in most cases, what people do when these things are threatened, when you kind of come at their support beams of their house with your sledgehammer, is they're not gonna say, "Oh, you know what? Let me look at that wall. I don't really think it needs to be there. Thank you for doing that." Most of the time, they're probably going to attack you. They're going to jump on you. They're going to grab the sledgehammer, throw it away, and be like, "Leave that alone. You're ruining my house, man." And so that's exactly what we do in our daily life. We're not going to sit there and have this really reflective, thoughtful, like interesting, like, "Huh, I never really thought about, you know, what purpose this room in my house serves or what it's doing. Thank you for destroying it." What we're going to do is we're going to either attack the person or the objects around them. And we're going to do that for the preservation of ourself and our reality. And that's generally how it's going to happen. In very rare cases, can we move people to a place where they start to evaluate those things, where they start to consider those structures. And one of the things that as Jonathan mentioned earlier is it's because trauma can result from attacking somebody's structures. And I think for me, on a couple personal notes, you know, my exit from Mormonism wasn't necessarily me going and looking at these support structures and saying, you know, "I think I don't really like that. Let me adjust." It was more like, "That wall's coming down. That thing's not working anymore." And trying to figure out how to readjust to that. And there was a fair amount of trauma involved. And it was more like trying to survive and scrambling. And having people come in and attack that would not have been useful at the time. I also have many family members that are deeply devout members. And one of the stories that I wanted to share with all of you to kind of, again, reemphasize how some of these more rigid, more protected structures develop in others happened with my sister must have been 4 years, 5 years, 6 years ago. 6 years ago, there was a really bad accident. I won't go into the details, but she lost her son. And it was really, really traumatizing for the family, for myself, for her. And the whole family was very much in grieving. And my sister Christina is also deeply devout. And I know that the Book of Mormon and the church gave her comfort, gave her peace. It gave her a way to connect to her child that she lost. And it allowed her to find meaning and value in that. And so when folks come to challenge or attack her ideas or her values, that would be something that would disgust me. It would be unethical and, in my opinion, evil to harm her house and to attack those structures that allow her to live a happy, safe life that has given her meaning and has eased her pain. So, I think that's kind of the value of these things can't be underestimated, and respecting them in others, I don't think, can be understated, because they often are serving very life-saving purposes. However, there are times when people think they're engaging each other. Oh, did we?
So I'm having a very gentle conversation with my uncle, who's quite elderly. And I took a little chunk of the frame in our conversation. But I could see that his response was immediate. that's the strategy?
Well, we definitely, So the question is, when we come up against someone and we realize that they're not going to discuss this, we backpedal? Is that the question?
Well, yeah, I took a little chip out of his framework.
Okay, yeah, you noticed that you had hit it.
And he immediately came up with the normal, where's your evidence?
Right.
And he was very, you know, you could see it in his eyes. I didn't want to go there. I wanted to have this gentle conversation.
Yes. Right.
And kind of wanted to come at it from a little different direction.
Right.
So I recognize the sensitivity is boundaries.
Yes. And so we're gonna that's a perfect question, and we will address that in our content that we have today. So everyone kind of hold that in your mind, is what do we do when we bump up against these and others, or we notice that we kinda hit them. One of the things that often happens is we have such diverging worldviews as our lives develop and as our values inform us and as we survive and as we do these things. And this was never more apparent to me than in the Bill Nye Ham at the Creation Museum debate. Did anybody here watch that or see that? Got a few hands? Okay. Do you want me to take that or do you want to? So I watched it, and a lot of my existential dread grew as I was like, it really was kind of traumatizing. I was like, Bill, you're saying it's all false. Anyway, one of the things that occurred to me was how I felt after I watched that was like I had watched the most masterful game of chess get played side by side with the most masterful game of checkers I've ever seen. And neither one engaged each other at any point. There was no, the dialogue was completely parallel. There was no intersection. And it was two beautiful monologues, but it was not a debate. There was zero dialogue for addressing the real question, which would have, I wish I could be moderator and go back there. And ask them, these are some of the comments that came up later about who won the debate. And I was actually shocked when I found that people thought that Ham had won. I was dumbfounded at first. I was like, what? I was like, Nye destroyed him. Didn't you see that game of chess? Anyway, yeah, I kind of lost my train of thought. So the thing that I would have liked to have seen was I wish that they could have had the conversation of, why do you value science, Bill? What does it do for you? What are the reasons that you have dedicated your life to this domain of inquiry? And Ham, what is about revealed truth that brings so much meaning to you? Can we talk about the qualities and the aspects of these various ways of being and how they inform human life? And what are these qualities? And can we maybe argue that there are harms and qualities that need to be fleshed out in both of these worldviews? I think Bill would have had a great time talking about how science can give us all of these things. It can help people live happier, cleaner, safer lives, and that it adapts very quickly to new content, where I would imagine that Ham could have talked about the communities that build and evolve through story and narrative and the power of those things, and how bringing people together through tradition and these kind of things is what he values. And I would have loved to have seen that. That would have been them in dialogue. But as we've talked about, both of them had their fundamental rules insulated from dialogue, and they were playing their own separate games, and they never joined, and there was never a meeting of the minds or a real discussion.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and also, as Josh touched on, each of the debaters in there, both Nye and Ham, they were each using what they considered to be evidence, as Josh illustrated through science, what science has revealed and what revealed truth indicates through the scriptures. And they valued their respective evidence and consequently did not care as much about the evidence that the other party was bringing to the table. And so here is the eternal struggle. Many of you who have your conversations on Facebook and got to correct the internet, got to correct all those people with their false beliefs, and their bad ideas. The internet is counting on you all. can't come to bed. And it is wrong. And so now we're going to get into, you know, that we've established that these absolutisms here, we all have them. They're essential for our functioning. They're very useful to us, but they can get into the way of effective dialogue, effective discussion, and meaningful growth for people. Now, how can we approach these conversations and to make it work better for us? Okay, and most important is to start with yourself. I'm going to invoke some of the Broadway Hamilton. Aaron Burr's song, wait for it. I am the one thing in life I can control. Love that line. And I want you all to remember that when you're engaging, starting off into this, is start with yourself. You can't get into the lives of other people and start knocking down their pillars. Examine your own pillars first. See what you can learn from them. Increase your own self-awareness. So, what we mean by that is, like, recognize that, yes, and this point that we keep emphasizing, recognize that you have your absolutisms. If you're kind of wondering, what absolutisms do I have? That's a good first step. Think about what they can be.
I just wanted to say, there might be some of you out here that think, oh, I don't have any. And I just wanted to point out, you are the most enslaved and subjected to your absolutisms, those of you who think you don't have them. Because those who are aware of them, it's basically like, know the God you serve, because there is no not serving one. By that I mean your objective reality. Get really intimately aware of it, because the more you think you don't have it, the less power you have to be aware and start to integrate that knowledge into your life to empower yourself.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, precisely. So ask yourself, what are these gods? You know, it could be the God of Mormonism, God of Isaac, Abraham, and Jacob, or it could be science. Science could be your God. Ask yourself what that is, and what are these values that you hold so dear that are off the table for discussion that you would rather not have examined in a conversation. And also, as you examine yourself, you'll bump into things that make you uncomfortable, and so you'll develop empathy and being able to consider the safety of another person who is rigidly holding on to their worldview, and preventing its fragility from being examined. Handle care with yourself also, and handle care with others especially. Start small, like any new lifestyle change. You don't want to go to yoga and do all the stretches. You're going to hurt yourself. So if it's your first time, assumedly. But start small, start with some basics. Then you'll work up to more advanced techniques, more advanced stretches. And it won't hurt as much because you'll have prepared.
Yeah, another, one of the more popular kind of things that's going on in psychology right now is mindfulness. And everyone's like, be mindful, be curious. So I'm just going to hammer on that. I think that it's true. It's very useful to feed the fire of your own curiosity. Get safe. Start noticing things. Try to remove shame and just look at it. Wonder, why is this thing so hard for me to question? What value does it serve? What's going on here? How can I get to know myself better? So that when somebody does say this, I can say, this idea might seem kooky or whatever, but I don't discuss that for XYZ reason. You don't have to go expose yourself to people either. You don't have to be overly vulnerable, but that self-knowledge can be deeply empowering to kind of close the gap between these different parallel worlds that we all inhabit and bring people in a really powerful way. But I think it does start with really stoking your own curiosity, getting safe enough to go there, going at your own pace, like Jonathan said. You don't want to pull a muscle, just stretch nice and easy, kind of increase that awareness and just, maybe start to consider that you do have these things going on. And then we move into the interpersonal. So what do we do when we come up against someone else's? How do we handle this? I think describing the qualities and the properties of your worldview and why that's useful for you can be a great place to start. I construct the world this way. And of course, these are only for when the conversation is safe and a person is engaging you as an equal and you're not being harmed, and you can do that safely.
Yeah, and kind of addressing the question earlier of, you know, if you run into somebody's absolutisms and you see them, you know, tightening up their defenses, I mean, so do you pack battle? Yes, you do to an extent. And, you know, engage the situation. Like, if they're really not having this discussion, then, yeah, I can backpedal completely. Because that's not a conversation that will benefit you or them. But a handy thing is to make the conversation, address it from the points that you are aware of. So kind of start from your experience and your values, and explain why that's important, why that is important to you, as opposed to maybe like picking at you know, whatever the other person's values are. So give them something to compare to, as opposed to knocking it down straight off. If that makes sense.
Yeah, go ahead.
Shifted it away from the tension to flattery, and I don't know if that's a shameful strategy or not.
Well, no, I think what we're hearing is reflecting and saying, hey, I noticed I bumped up against something here, and that's okay, I don't have to go there. And yeah, sometimes it can feel like, you know, I had an experience with my dad where I was just hammering at him at one point on the phone. I was really angry and I was like, there's no archaeological evidence for the Book of Mormon. And he was like, son, there's plenty of evidence. And I also was pained. I something hit a chord in me and I thought, oh my gosh, what the hell am I doing? Why am I doing this? Like, what? This is not right. This is abusive and wrong. And I felt that in myself. And I said, Dad, I love that you love the Book of Mormon. You keep it. And we moved on. And I still stand by that. I think that I was in the wrong. And so the idea here is kind of stretching ourselves into a way where we can begin to get into dialogue with each other around the conversations that we can have, the ones where we can join each other. Yeah, so examining fear and the component that plays in kind of trapping people into their absolutisms, making them more rigid and less available for dialogue.
And also naming the fear.
Oh, and being given an opportunity to name the fear, to bring it out of this felt chaos and put it into its own way of a person kind of gaining power over it and talking about it. Is that fair synopsis of what you're introducing? We're trying to figure out a way to get everyone to be able to talk on the microphone because these are recorded, so the podcast listeners will be like, what the hell are they talking about?
If you have a question, would you mind coming up here and speaking into the mic just so we can get it on the recording?
And during the Q&A, we can certainly come back to any of those things you wish to discuss further. We just wanted to, I think this is our last thing, right? Okay, so yeah, we wanted to end with a... Yeah. Yeah, we'll just want to end with a word of caution here. And so what we've introduced here, and this is kind of a bit of irony, what we've introduced to you here to you, this these ideas that we've put forth, they are in themselves a rule set. And so, like, there's no escaping that, no matter how you go about this, you're always going to be playing a game of some sort. You're always going to be following a rule set. And, you know, the rule sets we've introduced, approaching these things with compassion, with love, and trying to be respectful where people are at. Those are rule sets in and of themselves, and are open for examination, frankly. And so, as we mentioned here, like, even if your rule set favors peace and coexistence, it's still a rule set that can bump up into other people's rule sets. And even that most charitable of approaches can be seen as an attack on their beliefs, if their beliefs are exclusionary. And so even if you're trying to be helpful and compassionate and doing all these things to help the other person grow and thrive and flourish, you're still going to run up against some stuff. We just wanted to leave that as a word of caution.
Yeah, so essentially, I like to think of it this way, and then we'll open up the Q&A. We're all students. None of us are the teacher. And even if we're a very peaceful, kind student, we're still in the class with other students. And so kind of approaching it with humility and kindness and openness, even to rule sets that maybe aren't favoring peace and coexistence, is still important. And with that, thanks so much for everybody coming. Appreciate you being here, and love to hear from you and your questions.
So yeah, if anyone has a question, if you wouldn't mind coming up here and speaking into the mic.
I'm thinking back on a particular situation where I thought a friend made a very ridiculous statement about totally ignoring carbon-14 dating, that it's completely worthless. The way I handled that question was to say, well, you know, the whole concept of radioactive decay was used in the production of the atomic bomb. Do you think all of those people working on the Manhattan Project were a bunch of idiots then, and they just happened to just get lucky in what they were doing? So if I can conceptualize that, the intent was to try and ask a question that pointed up the fallacy of the other person's view, but not push it any further than that. Comment on that, if you would.
Yeah. And so, that's a great question. And I do think that is important. I've heard this mentioned in other panels before, that when we're too comfortable, we don't change. And so I think that it is important to bring a little bit of discomfort in people's lives, because that forces them to examine their pillars. If they never examine their pillars, then that can also be an issue. Within reason, it's good and acceptable. And this is a case by case judgment. You have to make this judgment call for yourself of when it is appropriate to bring these issues up and how to bring it up. Our only recommendation is do so as gently as possible. And I don't know if how that conversation went. I hope it went well. But
how did the conversation go? How did it work?
Well, eventually she just said, well, ignore it.
Yeah, that's exactly what I thought happened. When I heard you introduce it, that was my assumption. And the reason why is I've been there a million times. I've been in your shoes, and I've said, you can't have this unless you take this, right? You can't have the A-bomb existing if you're not going to acknowledge carbon fiber dating, right? How are you doing this? And I'm pointing out their logical flaws. It doesn't really bring us together. Most of the time, what it does is, what Jonathan's pointing out, is it can allow us to nudge them, maybe. But they're most likely going to defend against that. Sometimes
it takes 100 nudges before they get there. But.
Right. Or the 100 nudges make them double, triple, quadruple down. It just depends on the person. Like, it really does. So, I think we need to introduce both those ideas. But the point is, you know, I've been there. I have. And I've wanted to say those things. But what we're introducing today is a way to ask them, what is it about carbon dating that you don't value? Like, what's going on here? Can you talk about that and get to maybe some of those more subtext and dig a little deeper and try to meet where you can. That's my comment.
So I have kind of an observation as well as a question. Sometimes the things that we're very passionate about bring forth emotion, and I know you didn't talk a lot about how emotion plays into stuff versus logic. But I notice that when I'm having conversations about things I'm passionate about, like LGBT rights, and then discussing these things with like really orthodox religious people, and then discussing maybe the refugee things. I work as a nurse in an inner city hospital, and I have a bunch of beautiful children that I care for that have escaped horrific situations. So of course, and I have a gay son. So these are two topics for me that bring about a lot of emotion. But I'm such a proponent of story sharing because I feel like, I mean, a lot of the discussions we're discussing here are like fact-based kind of things versus lived experience as well as your emotional attachment to something. And I find that when I share personal stories, that moves the needle more than anything. But there are times as well when I feel like, am I crossing the line into manipulation? Am I manipulating somebody into seeing my point of view by working on their emotions? And so I don't know if you guys want to address that, but maybe there's a fine line there. And because I am an emotional person and passionate about things, that sometimes perhaps I can run over somebody with my lived experience. So how do you find that balance?
Thank you so much for sharing that. I think that's a hugely important piece that we didn't bring into the conversation very much, and I think you did an excellent job of introducing that idea. My only advice is just personal thoughts on that. I don't have any research or anything well thought out, but my idea would be to be reflective and thoughtful around what your motives are. If you're wondering if you're manipulating or getting too pushy, and do self-care around those things and make sure that you're able to be safe. That would be my thought. And then hopefully from that safety comes the ability to engage with others a little more, with a little maybe less pressure and a little more openness and willingness to, you know, keep doing what you're doing, which is sharing those really important stories that are so valuable and powerful. Exactly, yeah.
The way you're looking at this, people could be harmed.
Yes, yes.
So it feels like a moral thing to me.
Yes, yes.
And yet, uh-huh. I know that somehow I need to make or help them be able to express their point of view. But it feels so wrong to me that it's really hard.
It's so complicated, so difficult. To be in that. It's saying, hey, I see that this pillar is like holding you up, but it's also holding a lot of other people down, and I wish you could see that. That is so complicated. It's so difficult, and that's ideally what we're hopefully here to do, is give all of us more tools to start to work on those, because they're so individual, they're so tied up, and it is that passion that makes us feel right, and we do see real harm. And so hopefully we're all working in this exact issue that you're bringing up. This is the problem, and this is what we're trying to do. I mean, we've got all these things on the line, and so it is, how do we negotiate this? I don't have those answers. I think this information hopefully helps and moves us toward that.
There's an idea from literature that's somewhat similar to what you're talking about. My brother is an English professor, and for years now he's quoted me something Joan Didion said, in 1979, this essay that she wrote was picked as one of the most 10 most important essays since 1950. And in this essay, she says, and this is the most important part from the essay, we tell ourselves stories in order to live. And I think about that a lot. It helps us understand that we ourselves are telling stories, and other people are too.
Yeah, thank you for that comment. That's absolutely true. Yeah. Right. I recall reading a newspaper story about a year ago. It talked about a Sunday school teacher living somewhere near here in Salt Lake who was, one week was asked a question about the blacks and the priesthood exclusion, and the next week he revisited that lesson using an essay from the Gospel Topics on LDS.org as a primary source for that, and later he got released from his calling for having used that as a source. So do you think that... So even though the LDS Church is trying to be more transparent about these sort of things, do you feel that these absolutisms are just so ingrained that challenging them will ever be acceptable?
That's a great question. I remember that story, and I remember having a good laugh. You know, we didn't get a ton of time to talk about this, but when certain things develop over time, they can become more rigid, and that rigidity of these absolutisms that are never questioned, they cause problems. They cause serious problems in individuals' lives and in systems. And so I think what you're pointing out is a very rigid, very guarded structure that's causing problems.
Yeah, and we certainly value the questioning of that and the raising of awareness around that issue, because you know it's bringing people into the conversation. We're actually starting to have dialogue around, well, is this okay? And you know we're examining that, and in a lot of cases we're saying no, it's not okay. And so, I mean, the dialogue is happening, and that's the ultimate goal that we want to get to. Is we want that dialogue to happen. It's not going to happen with everybody, but it's starting to happen with somebody, and that's important.
Did you gave up on your question? Okay.
I just wanted to ask, what techniques have you discovered, or your views on sort of taking a nuanced approach to discussions of big topic things like truth? And let me just provide a little context here to sort of frame the question. If someone was to approach me and to say, you know, I've read Aesop's Fables, and I think there's a lot of truth in them, one way for me to respond would be to say, are you kidding me? You just called fables true. I mean, there's nothing to back the historicity claims that a dog looked into a river and dropped a bone. This is, you know... Similarly, if someone was to approach me and say, I think the Book of Mormon is true, I could respond in a similar way, or I could instead say, hey, you know, it does contain these pretty amazing stories of characters that exhibited courage and faith and trust, and if that has meaning to you, then it is true to you. So if you could just speak to that topic a little bit.
The first thing that sticks out to me is in Mormonism, we have this colloquial use of true that's not typical in other communities. And so Lindsay Hansen-Park actually pointed this out on one of her Facebook posts. She said, what I think we're saying is this is meaningful for me. This is valuable. This is useful. This is important. And when we say true, a lot of times in the colloquial speak of Mormonism, that's what we're trying to articulate. We're trying to point to something that has deep, profound emotional resonance with us. And so I would just start there. What's the definition of true? Like, what does that mean for a person? What are they trying to say when they say that? And that might be a new question for some folks. So giving them some time to work through that, I think is useful. But of course, I believe that there's all sorts of different kinds of truth with different domains of knowledge and topics that vary.
Mm-hmm. And yeah, and just something I want to speak to that, you know, as a still active Mormon who believes... In the Book of Mormon, I acknowledge the possibility that it could be a historical document, which some of you may be like, scratch your head. I understand that, but what's great is that having people raise that issue with me has helped me to reevaluate my stance on it, and so that even though I do think that it's a historical book, that's not what's most important to me. What's most important to me is what you pointed out, is that truth from the stories and what they have done and benefited me in my life, the lessons that they tell. That's more important to me, and so you know, for me now, if you want to attack the historicity of the book murder, I'm just like, okay, whatever. Even if it isn't true, even if it never did happen physically, that's not going to crush me. It really isn't.
All right, I have time for one more question.
Okay, looks like we're almost out of time. And I appreciate many things you said, like I need to get off my high horse and not play the teacher and not let my passions, you know, overrule. But as I thought, maybe you should speak. What to me seems that I need to learn is what seems to be most effective when I observe, and that's the use of humor, the place of humor that humor can play when these things come budding up.
Yes, thank you. I think that humor is also very useful. I don't know if there was a question in there that I'm missing, or just appreciate the comment. So thank you. And thank you so much, everybody, for coming, and hopefully we'll all start discussing more things.